Are you ready for a whole new way of being in the world? Welcome to Living from the Inside Out with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is presence. And the numbers to call to just to be in conversation. I've been doing this opening for so many years. And it just feels today like it doesn't quite right to say, to call in for coaching on having what you want and thriving in every area of your life. Because what it seems to me is on offer in our conversations each week. And it does seem to me like that's what we're having is a conversation. I get I'm doing most of the talking, right? And occasionally you get a little proxy for you. Somebody will phone in on your behalf and ask your question for you. But what's on offer in these conversations is just a deeper look at life, a deeper look at what life is and how it works, a deeper look at the mind, what the mind really is and how it works, a deeper look at ourselves, who we are and how we work. And that deeper look does something for us. That fresh look, that willingness to look again and again and again and see what we can see that is true. Not our truth, like, yes, I am the kind of person who I prefer savories to sweets. I prefer football to baseball. I prefer this to that. Not that truth, right? That's honesty. But the kind of truth that's true whether you believe it or not. That's true whether you know it or not. Like that which is born dies. I don't know if you've noticed that. That's capital T truth. It is impervious to our belief systems. When you drop something, it falls. Also known as gravity. Right? That's capital T truth. You know, I said this in a blog post the other day that, you know, I notice with interest that no flat earther has ever fallen off the edge of the earth. And I notice with interest that no gravity denier, I don't know if there are gravity deniers, but no gravity denier has ever flown off into space. Right? There's kind of no arguing with capital T truth, but there is if you don't see it that way, if you don't think it's true, if you think somehow you are an exception to truth. That somehow you are the one who has been singled out, either as the exception because you're better than the rest of us, or as the exception because you're worse. Yeah, you don't know. You don't know, Michael. You don't know what I've been through. You're right. Of course I don't. But I know if you're human and incarnated on this planet, I know for a fact you have better days and worse days. You have days where you enjoy yourself more and days where you enjoy yourself less. There are times where you feel absolutely capable of absolutely anything and times where you are absolutely certain that you couldn't do anything worthwhile if your life depended on it. And I don't know that because I've joined the Hay House Psychic Stars. Right? Somebody actually was talking, I was just on a class and somebody said, do they like have competitions to audition where like the psychics kind of make predictions and whoever gets the most predictions right gets a radio show? And I was thinking, hey, Hay House, if you're listening, and I know you are, that might be really fun to put together something like that. But putting that to one side, that's not what I do. Right? I don't predict imaginary futures. Or real futures. I look to see, I sit with you each week to explore what's already true, that if only we knew it, it would make our lives so much easier. If only we saw who we really are, what we really are, what we're made of, our lives would be unrecognizable from the way most of us live. When you catch a glimpse of where happiness comes from, of the well-being that is part of your nature, not learned, not practiced, not techniqued, but simply who you are, the taste of oneness, the taste of God, the taste of life, the one taste that is delicious, that changes everything. If you can see anything about the truth of where our experience comes from, that we live in a thought-created reality, and it's just a really good virtual reality generator we live inside of, which is why we're so convinced, no, this isn't thought-created reality. I know what thought is like. Right? I remember my wife and I often joke about, she grew up on a farm, and one of her dad's friends was also a farmer. And we had dinner with her dad and the other farmer, and they were having an argument. And the line that we both remember from the argument is, "Don't tell me that. I know sheep, Alistair. I know sheep." Right? "Don't tell me what I'm experiencing that is so awful is thought. I know it's because of whatever it is I think it's because of. Don't tell me that this amazing feeling that I feel is thought. It's because of whatever I think it's because of." And we get very protective of our thought-created realities because we want them to be permanent. Now, what's funny is it makes sense that we want them to be permanent when they're good, when we enjoy them. It makes sense that, no, don't tell me this is temporal. Don't tell me this is of time. Don't tell me this could change. I want this. I want this to always be the way. But we do that even with things that we hate. Don't tell me this is temporal. Don't tell me this will pass. This is real. I am never going to get up over this. Right now, what's interesting, like, I have teenage daughters. Actually, I have one teenage daughter left. The other one is no longer a teenager. But I have yet to have the, "Don't tell me that I'll get over this, that I'll ever fall in love again." But it's happened so often, it's a cliche, right? "Don't tell me this is temporal, this is of time. This is permanent. This is real." But what it actually is this is present. This is happening now. And so in a way, this is all there is for now. But the beautiful thing about now is now is the space inside which experience occurs. Now is not a moment in time different to past and future. Now is spaciousness. Now is possibility. Now is outside of time. It's beyond time. So we think of being present as one of three choices. I can be in the past, I can be in the future, or I can be present. And we kind of intuitively know or have been taught the present's better, right? Because everything happens now. But we think of now as a moment in time, when now is the space beyond time. And that space beyond time, what I write about in my books as the space within, pure consciousness, our true nature, that is where presence happens. So we think of presence often. We use that word as a descriptor to talk about somebody who's particularly charismatic or someone who there's just something about them. I remember years ago, and I will take calls, and I forgot that bit. If you wanted to call in and chat about something specific, 866-254-1579, toll free in the United States and Canada. 866-254-1579, outside the United States and Canada, 001-760-918-4300. But we go in a different direction. Let me come at this another way. So presence is, to my mind, another word for God. So Anita Morjani and I, most of you will know Anita from her book, Dying to Be Me, or her Hay House show, or her PBS special, or her upcoming movie, or whatever you know Anita from. But she and I decided that we wanted to do a program together. And we kind of discussed what it could be and the different things that it could be. And then I was reading a book called Practicing the Presence by Joel S. Goldsmith. And in it, he talked about not practicing being present, but practicing the presence, being in that space beyond time. That space where you are experiencing the pure river of aliveness in life and not getting overly distracted by the various forms that it takes, right? Because aliveness is in you. Aliveness is in me. Aliveness is in the world around us. But we think the form is what we fall in love with. We think the form is where the aliveness lives, but it's just what is being in formed by the aliveness. And we kind of started working on this program, and then we both kind of realized at the same time, oh, we're totally chicking out, because we were calling the program Experiencing the Presence, or Experiencing Presence was another title. And I kind of said to her, kind of sheepishly, kind of embarrassed, like, I think we're really kind of saying experiencing God. And she was like, yeah. I was like, should we change it? She was like, yeah. So the program's not available yet. It will be available later this month, beginning of August. But we are doing a live program in September here in LA, September 15th and 16th. So if you want to learn more about that, if you go to michaelneal.org/store/experiencing-God, and I'll put it on the Facebook page. That's michaelneal.org/store/experiencing-God. You can join us for that. But essentially presence is that sweetness of feeling the electricity of life running through you. It is that sweetness of being present to life. In time, in real time, beyond time. The timeless moment. The story I started to tell earlier, we had a woman come in to speak on one of my programs called Nancy Klein. She's written a number of books, but my favorite of her books, the book I met her through, was a book called Time to Think. And the essential premise of her book was that when people are given time to think, they invariably, their wisdom comes through. They can find the solution to any problem. They can see if there is a real problem. That just giving them time to think, one of the things she'll often say is, how far can somebody go in their own thinking before they need mine? Right. Now, that's a very different way of listening that that would point to. Because it suggests that you're not listening to respond. You're listening to see, wow, I wonder how far they can get with this before they need input from me or from something outside them. And it turns out, in my experience, that it is extraordinary how far someone can go if you really give them the time, give them the space. Well, in order to do that, you kind of have to find presence. You kind of have to find that space outside of time where the whole thing can unfold. Now, I'd met her. I'd met her socially. We'd had tea. But I'd never seen her teach. And she came into my group and she stood at the front of the room. I have never felt the urge to give somebody a standing ovation before they opened their mouth before. And when somebody was asking me, what was that? And I was like, you felt it too? And everybody, we all felt it. And I was like, that's presence. That is somebody who is so present to the awe of life, to the aliveness of life, to the beauty of life, of our shared humanity. That there's no desire to go anywhere else. There's no desire to travel back into the past or head into the future, to entertain yourself, to cheer yourself up or drag yourself down. I explained it to somebody who wasn't there as it was like when she stood up at the front of the room, God stood up with her. Now, you may have experienced moments like that for yourself when you looked into one of your children's eyes. Or if you look into the eyes of a pet. Or sometimes you just are struck by the beauty of nature. The point, they call it a Stendhal moment. Where it's so beautiful it almost hurts. Those are moments outside of time. Presence is outside of time. And that's just one of the possibilities for life. That is a capital T truth. There is a space beyond time. Sid Banks, the mystic, used to say life is a divine dream suspended between the boundaries of time, space, and matter. And what that means to me is that what we think of as life, you know, real life, not that made up thinking stuff, real life, is a divine dream. It's not even our dream, right? It's the collective dream of 7.5 billion of us. And in order for that dream to seem real, you need some boundaries. You need time. Right? Now, there's no time in nature. Right? That's why in native cultures, they would talk about how many moons something was. Right? Because they could recognize, oh, the moon is full, then it's empty, then it's full, then it's empty, then it's full, then it's empty. So we can count by that. But that's made up. We know that's made up. Oh, well, yeah, but days aren't made up. Well, you can count by when you see the sun, when you don't see the sun, light and dark. You can make that up as a unit of time. It could be helpful because time is helpful in the divine dream. Well, yeah, but the calendar, I mean, there's 365 days in a year. It didn't used to be. Right? Back when the earth was the center of the universe. I don't know if you remember back that far. I wasn't around. But back when the earth was the center of the universe and they decided that, hey, let's make up a name for how long it takes the sun to go all the way around the earth. It was like 360-ish days of these sun up, sun down units that we were calling days. And so the math wouldn't work. So about every 10 years, the calendar would just be off. And they would reset. They would go, okay, we're going to just get rid of a month so that the calendar works again. And then some people figured out, well, what if the Earth isn't the center of the universe? What if the sun is the center of the universe? What if it is a heliocentric universe? And one of them, I'd like to say, was brave enough to publish, but Copernicus, who we all kind of think of as the founder of that, he was sort of brave, but actually he published on his deathbed. He published when it was too late for anyone to do anything to him, to prevent him. And suddenly the math worked and they could make time work. But time has always been made up. Space, right? This concept of space and matter, because they're really twin concepts, right? There's space and there's matter. There's solid and there's the space in which the solids exist, right? There's water and there's ice and there's air, which are all made of the same stuff, by the way. Right, H2O can be solid, it can be liquid, it can be gas. But if we make them up as separate, we can create a world of form. Cool. It's fun to have a world of form with time in it. Because then you can have football games. Right? Because then you can make up countries, and you can make up religions, and you can make up tribes, and you can make up money, and you can make up all these other things that make sense in a game that is played out between the boundaries of these three imaginary concepts, time, space, and matter. I was a little bit of a math geek growing up. Not a big math geek. My brother and sister were big math geeks. And with my brother, it served him very well. He was a director of engineering at Google for many years and a number of startups. So being a math geek can work out in our modern culture. But I was fascinated by Euclidean geometry. And one of the things I was fascinated by was that Euclidean geometry is based on three completely made up principles. Three made up concepts. A point, a line, and a plane. So if you make up a point, right, the idea of a point, there are no points in nature, but if you draw just like a dot on a piece of paper and call it a point, and then you extend that dot infinitely in one horizontal plane and call it a line, and then you extend that dot infinitely in every direction, and it's called then a plane. So you have a line, a point, and a plane. Now, there are no planes in nature. There are no points in nature. There are no lines in nature, though we can visualize them. We can turn something in nature into a line. Then you can do everything that you can do with Euclidean geometry. You can design houses. You can triangulate locations. You can do much of what we have been able to do in the world of architecture just through working with these three ideas. Well, it's the same with life. The divine dream suspended between the boundaries of time, space, and matter. Right? What's the first thing we make up in the game? Well, we need players. Oh, let's make up me. Let's create me as separate to you, and then we can play against each other. Right? There's an old story that can be found in multiple cultures, and that's the nature of myth. The nature of myth is it's a way of explaining life that makes sense within the culture that it was created for, that it was created out of. And there's a myth that permeates multiple cultures, which is that in the beginning, there was God, or there was one, or there was consciousness. And consciousness became bored, right? Consciousness decided it would be interesting to be able to experience itself. But in order to do that, it needed to divide itself into lots of separate pieces so that it could experience itself through another. And in the Judeo-Christian mythology, that was, oh yeah, and then God created this, and God created that, and God created this, and then they were named. So they became even more real, even more separate, and then the game unfolded. In other cultures have just variations on that theme, where the God himself or herself splits into all these parts. In Judaism, the notion of tikkun olam, that in the beginning there was God, there was light, there was oneness, and the light needed a vessel in which it could be contained. But the vessel broke and shattered into 7.5 billion pieces, each one bearing a little bit of the original light. And so tikkun olam, the repair of the world, is the process of bringing all the pieces of light back together, of reassembling the vessel, of returning to the whole. Well, these are all different ways that we have of trying to describe the game of life. And why it's a game, even when it doesn't feel like one. Why game is a legitimate metaphor, because if you want to have a game, you have to make up rules. And then without rules, there's no game, right? Unless it's the no rules game, right? There's a game the kids used to love, and I actually really liked, called Flux, F-L-U-X-X. And it's a card game. And what makes it different from other card games is that there are rules cards. And so let's say the rules are that all the yellow cards are good and all the blue cards are bad. But then somebody might play a card on the next turn that changes the rules, and now all blue cards are good and all yellow cards are bad. And what makes it fun is that the rules are always in flux. So you can't plan too far ahead. You have to kind of stay responsive to what's going on now, knowing that it could all change in a heartbeat. I think the reason they got that game so right is because that's closer to how the game of life works. There are relatively few fixed rules in the game of life, right? That which is born dies. That's one. Nothing floats off into space by itself. That's another. You can't fall off the edge of the planet, though you can fall off lots of edges on the planet. That's another. But then we make up all these other rules. We make up rules like, you have to be this kind of person to go to heaven. You have to be this kind of person to be loved or worthy of love. You have to do these things and not those things to be acceptable, to be okay, to be enough. You have to achieve these things to be worthy. You have to avoid these things to be good. And then we do our best, given the rules that we don't know were made up. And we wonder why it's so hard to win the game. Well, in studies of society, and not our society, but societies in general, and culture, they talk about a healthy culture and a toxic culture. And a healthy culture is a culture where if you abide by the rules of the culture, things work. And a toxic culture is a culture where if you followed all the rules of the culture, it just gets worse. And we live, for better or for worse, in a toxic culture, because if you do everything that you're told, you will wind up a mess. right? Because you've got to, you know, money's good, but money's also evil. And loving people is good, but loving them too much, kind of dodgy. And you mustn't fight, but you must defend what's yours. And it's a losing game. The game is set up to lose, right? Even capitalism is ultimately a losing game. It's just nobody's made up a better one that's sustained yet. And what makes it a losing game is if you follow all the rules, you still lose. But here's the thing. If you can see which rules are made up and which ones are fixed, which things are commonly agreed on, as opposed to which ones are fundamentally true, which ones are fixed and which ones are variable, you experience a thing we call freedom. Because you're getting closer to presence. You're getting closer to that space outside of the game. And when somebody shows up in the game from the space outside of the game, from the space inside of which the game unfolds, we call them enlightened. We call them the Son of Man. We call them Buddha. We call them whatever it is that in our culture we use to describe such a person. They are in the world, but not of it. But here's the thing. We can all touch that space. And we do. We touch that space anytime we get truly quiet. That's why meditation is so cool. Right now, I know if you listen to the show, you know one of the things I talk about a lot is not meditating. But what I mean by not meditating is that you don't need a practice to touch the space. You can have one. But we are that space. It would be like, I must have a practice to have a nose. No, you have a nose. And for some people, having a practice that reminds them of that fact is really helpful. But it's not necessary. Meditation, the state of meditation, the state of presence, the conscious state of one consciousness. We can touch that any moment. We're one thought away from it. And the reason we're one thought away from it is because the only reason we don't experience it is because we experience thought. So here's how it seems to me. The game is set up for us. Right? We are of this underlying energy, this underlying spaciousness. We are presence. That is our nature. We are given the gift of thought. This incredible creative force that literally allows us to take the raw material of consciousness and create worlds, galaxies, infinite galaxies from that one energy, that one formless no thing, no thingness, nothingness. Everything comes from no thing. Everything comes from love. Everything is created via thought. Not a particular thought that you might affirm or affirm its opposite, but the energy of thought itself, this creative force that can turn heaven into hell and hell into heaven in a heartbeat. And then we're given or maybe we are, I don't know which, this divine spark of life that will turn our creative thoughts into reality. It will enliven them. It will animate them. It is the spark of life that God gave to Adam in the painting on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Which, if you've never been, I gotta tell you, I'm not a particularly religious guy, but I saw that. It is magnificent. There is something beautiful about that. I'd seen many pictures of it. I even used to have a picture of it on my wall of my office. But it's not a patch on the real thing. But you know what? Beautiful as that painting is, it's not a patch on the real thing either, because it's just a representation of how that spark of life is in us. That spark of the divine is in the human, is in you, is in me, is in all of us. So we get this spark of life, this catalyst that brings everything to life. That is life itself, the movement of life, the electricity of life, the aliveness of life. And that animates us. That brings thought to life. It brings genius to life. It brings possibility to life. But it can also bring monsters to life and demons to life and fear to life. It is a value-neutral gift. It is pure creative potential. And then we get this thing, this aspect of consciousness that we could call discernment. That which allows us to discriminate, not in the negative sense, but in the very, very practical sense, between illusion and reality, between that which is of time. That's what illusion means. Illusion, illusory, means that which is temporal, that which will come and go, that which is non-permanent. Real, as it's used in Eastern teachings, as it's used in spiritual teachings, is that which does not come and go, that which is neither born nor dies, that which was here before you and will be here beyond you. And that discernment, that discriminatory function, allows us to navigate the game of life with a high degree of ease and grace. Because think about it like this. In a way, it's the difference between playing God of War or Call of Duty if you're a gamer and actually being in a war. Right? The great thing of Call of Duty and all those games, right? The great thing about them is you get all the thrill of being in battle. And I know that if you've been in real battle, you might not consider it a thrill, but I also know from the soldiers I've spoken with that if you've been in battle, there is a thrill. It doesn't outweigh things, but it's there. But in a video game, you get the thrill of that. But if your guy gets killed, it's okay. It's just a game. You can do it again. Right? If your friend gets killed in the game, it's okay. It's just a game. It doesn't become less fun because your character can die. That's part of the fun of it. See, but we think our game, when we die, it's game over. So it's not as fun. Now, here's the thing. I didn't die like Anita Morjani. I have not escaped this earthly plane like a Jesus or a Buddha. So I cannot tell you, Michael Neal, radio show host, hey, don't worry about it. It's just a game. You'll just reincarnate. I don't know. But I find it interesting that all the people who seem to have found the place of presence, who seem to have been able to be in the game but not of the game, spoke to the eternal life. Spoke to the fact of life beyond the game. And for me, even the thought of that does something for me. It lets me take the game no less seriously, but a lot less seriously. Right? I had a bunch of people over yesterday to watch the World Cup, where I lived in England for 14 years. Most of my family are English. And so we were rooting for England, except for the two people who weren't. And we knew it was a game. But if you'd seen us, you might have thought the fate of the free world was hanging in the balance. Like, if you'd watched us watching the game but not known what we were watching, you might have thought we were watching the celebrity death match where people were actually dying. But you see, it was fun. We did it willingly. We would gladly do it again on Sunday if we'd won. Because at some level, knowing it's a game lets you enjoy it more, not less. Knowing it's just a game lets you play it more full out, not, it's just a game. You know, one of the metaphors I'll use on the show a lot is, we don't go to the movies to be reminded that they're just movies. We go to the movies to lose ourselves in them. To suspend our disbelief. To get so caught up in the imaginary world of the movie, and we know it's imaginary, and lose ourselves in it to the point where we feel things as if we were really there, as if it was really happening. Our entire life is a movie. And if we know it's a movie, that frees us up to enjoy it all the more. And if we don't know it's a movie, it is really hard to enjoy, feel good about, or even handle some of the stuff that happens on the screen. I remember seeing the movie Platoon when it first came out. It was a Vietnam War film. I guess this would have been in the late 80s, with Willem Dafoe and Charlie Sheen and Tom Berenger. And I thought that was amazing. I think that was one of the best war movies ever made. Certainly one of the best I've ever seen. And I remember it was so vivid that when I came out of the movie theater, I was kind of half out of the movie theater and half still in the jungle. And then I remember going back to school, because I was at school at the time, and everyone was whispering, we're going to war, we're going to war, we're going to war. And it turned out that the day that I had seen the movie, and I can't remember who the United States had invaded that day, whether it was Grenada or someone else, but something had happened, and people thought there was going to be a big war. And I was so still in the world of the film that it was terrifying to me. And then later that evening, I realized, wow, that was just a movie. Even though my heart thumped no less than it would have if it had been real. Even though it was based on a true story. Even though I was an actor at the time. I know how movies are made. I know that even as these incredible scenes of violence and horror were being filmed, there were hundreds of people sitting around eating ham sandwiches, holding boom mics and cameras, creating the illusion to be enjoyed, to be experienced. Life is here to be experienced. But if we never see outside it, if we cannot find presence, if we cannot have moments of being in presence outside of the game, outside of the movie, outside of time, then the movie's not a movie. I used to, on my courses, programs, I used to ask a sort of a Zen koan, or at least my version of one. And the question that I would ask people is, when is a dream not a dream? And the answer that I came to was, a dream is not a dream when the dreamer never awakens. A game is not a game when the gamer never knows it's a game. If you've seen the Matrix movies, the Matrix movies probably do the best job of any set of movies I've ever seen of creating a representation of how the game works. Right? And if you haven't seen it for a while, if you've never seen it, it has a lot of violence, a lot of sex, right? It's essentially the, you know, how the game of life works, what the space outside of the game is like. And there's a lot of leather and bullets, right? But the essential idea is, and this is where I think the movie doesn't quite match my experience, that when you're in the game, you're so hypnotized by the game, but when you're out of the game, that's the real world. And the real world's kind of dingy. Like in the movie, the real world, the game's nicer. Like there is a character in the first of the movies who actually asks to forget that he woke up, to forget that he stepped outside of the Matrix, to be plugged back into the Matrix, back into the illusion, to be rehypnotized so that he can enjoy a steak again. But my experience is exactly the opposite. The more I experience presence, the more I am able to live outside the game, but in the game, the richer the game comes. I don't want to not be in the world. I want to be in the world, but maybe not of it. I want to be in the dream, but I want to be awake inside the dream. I want to be in the game knowing at some level that it is a game. And the way that happens, the gateway to that, is presence. It is simply falling back into that place in us that has never left, that was never created and can never be destroyed, that is eternal, immortal, universal, and infinite. Pure, unadulterated presence. And then the game tends to become fun. And when it's not fun, it's tolerable. So we cry in the game. We laugh in the game. We get angry in the game. We feel sad in the game. We feel happy in the game. We fall in love in the game. And the game is made so brilliantly, it all feels so real, so permanent, so couldn't be any other way. And yet there are glitches in the Matrix. We've all had moments where just for a moment, we fall out of the game and into the space inside of which the game is played. We wake back up to the movie theater and fall out of the world of the movie. And then our experience of the game is transformed. Our experience of the movie is transformed, even though we know we will be hypnotized back into the movie. We will fall back asleep into the dream. So while you or I may never truly wake up from the dream like an enlightened being, we can all wake up to the dream. We can all wake up to the fact that we are dreaming. We can all wake up to presence. We can all experience presence. How do you find what's never been lost? Well, how is it possible that we aren't awake to this all the time? Well, because it's a really good dream. Like, not good, maybe enjoyable, but good, like, wow, the special effects are off the charts. So while we don't always know where to look, we know where not to look. We know that presence, this space inside which, this space within which the game unfolds, we know it's not in the game, right? We're not going to find it in the game. That's the one place we know we will not find it, in the illusion, in the movie, in the dream. Now, every dream has characters in it that will whisper to us, you know you're dreaming. Every game has a few players in it, a few sages in it who will say, you know, this is just a game. And if we're lucky, if we listen, they will wake us up to the fact of the game. They will wake us up to the fact of the dream. They will wake us back up to the presence we are. But also, you can find the presence through silence. Not silence as in absence of noise, but silence as in the space in which noise is heard. You can look to silence, you can look to quiet, not quiet the absence of sound, quiet the space that allows us to hear sound. You can look to stillness, not stillness, the absence of movement. Stillness, the space in which movement is visible. You can find it in the simple feeling of being, the beautiful feeling of life itself running through the body. You are the aliveness. You are life. You are presence. And each time you wake up to that, even a little, each time you catch a glimmer of that, each time you feel that for even a moment, the game of life becomes more fun to play. You get better at it. And you learn, as my mentor George Pransky says, to be more grateful for the highs and more graceful with the lows. So I hope you enjoyed this little exploration of presence. We'll be back with a new show next week. You can find out more about what I do and what I talk about at michaelneal.org. And do consider joining us for Experiencing God with me and Anita Morjani. Go to michaelneal.org/store/experiencing-God. Till next time, have fun, learn heaps, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.